ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Hare Krishna. So today we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter number 5, Text number 14, 6514. And the title of the chapter is Narad Muni Cursed by Prajapati Daksha. So Daksha is cursing Narad, Narad Muni. Text number 14. नानारूपात्मनो बुद्धिः स्वैरी नीवागुणान्विता तन्निष्ठान् अगतस्येह किम् असत्कर्मभिर्भवेत्। नानारूपात्मनो बुद्धिः स्वैरी नीवागुणान्विता तन्निष्ठाम् अगतस्येह किम् असत्कर्मभिर्भवेत्। नानारूपात्मनो बुद्धिः स्वैरी नीवागुणान्विता तन्निष्ठाम् अगतस्येह किम् असत्कर्मभिर्भवेत्। नाना वेरियस रूपा हु हेज फॉर्म्स और ड्रेसेस आत्मनः ऑफ द लिविंग एंटिटी बुद्धिः द इंटेलिजेंस स्वैरीनी अ प्रोस्टिट्यूट हु फ्रीली डेकोरेट्स हरसेल्फ with different types of clothes and ornaments. Eva, like Guna Anvita, endowed with the mode of passion, and so on. Tat Nishtham, the cessation of that. Agatasya, of one who has not obtained Iha, in this material world. Kim asat karma bhi bhavet. What is the use of performing temporary fruitive activities? Translations and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. Narad Muni had described a woman who is professional prostitute. The Hariyashvas understood the identity of this woman. Mixed in the mode of passion, the unsteady intelligence of every living entity is like a prostitute who changes dresses just to attract one's attention. If one fully engages in temporary fruitive activities, not understanding how this is taking place, what does this actually gain? Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Now, Srila Prabhupada's purport is in two paragraphs. The first paragraph is quite explicit. No? So, in the interest of the demographic of the assembled devotees, I'm just going to tone it down, you know, just because children are also sitting there. So, if you're watching your phone, you will know me that I'm just toning it down. It's Srila Prabhupada's words, but we have got a lot of children here. A woman who has no husband declares herself independent, which means that she becomes a prostitute. A prostitute generally dresses herself in various fashions intended to attract a man's attention to her body. Today, it has become a much advertised fashion for a woman to almost go naked, covering her body only slightly in order to draw attention of a man to the parts of Bhavet. Thank you, Prabhu. So, where did we stop? Similarly, I'll pick it from there in any case. Yeah. Similarly, the intelligence of a living entity who does not turn his attention towards Krishna or the Krishna consciousness movement simply changes dress like a prostitute. So what Prabhupada is saying, and then we'll continue. What is the benefit of such foolish intelligence? So what Prabhupada is saying here is that our intelligence is unsteady. I just want you to remember this point, yeah, out of all that, that the intelligence of a conditioned soul is unsteady and it keeps changing. Kids, will you be able to remember that? We are talking about what? Changes in intelligence. That's the first point, yeah? Let's keep going. One should be intelligently conscious in such a way that he need no longer change from one body to another. What is the next change now? One body to another. So the first change Prabhupada mentioned was change of intelligence. The second change is change of body. Next paragraph. Karmis change their profession at any time. What's the third change? Profession, change of profession. Karmis change their profession at any moment, but a Krishna conscious person does not change his profession. For his only profession is to attract the attention of Krishna by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and living in a very simple life without following daily changes of fashion. What's the fourth change? Fashion. So what were the four? First one? Intelligence, then? Body, then? Profession, then? Passion. So the only constant here is the change. In our Krishna consciousness movement, fashionable persons are taught to adopt one fashion. In our Krishna consciousness movement, that means Prabhupada is talking to you and me, so pay attention now. In our Krishna consciousness movement, fashionable persons are taught to adopt one fashion, the dress of a Vaishnava with a shaved head and tilaka. They are taught to be always clean in mind, dress and eating in order to be fixed in Krishna consciousness. What is the use of changing one's dress, sometimes wearing long hair and long beard and sometimes dressing otherwise? This is not good. One should not waste his time in such frivolous activities. One should always be fixed in Krishna consciousness and take the cure of devotional service with firm determination. So the solution to all the four changes is what? Firm determination in Krishna consciousness. Om Agyanati Mirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakhaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Nama Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Presthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesha Sunyavadi Paschatya Desatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vashadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So as we noted, Prabhupada is talking about four changes. Changes of intelligence, changes of body, changes of fashion, and there was one more, changes of profession. Yeah, let's talk about intelligence, then we'll talk about body, and time permitting we might talk about the other two things as well. Yeah, so let's talk about intelligence. Now what is happening here is that Narad Muni is telling the sons of Daksha that what is the use of having unsteady intelligence? Our intelligence should be steady, it should be fixed. And why does he say all that? We'll go into that little later. But let's just straightforward go into this topic of intelligence, yeah? Let's look at different aspects of intelligence, first of all. You know, what is intelligence? How is it different from mind? What is its function? How do we make it how do we change it from being unsteady to steady? And how do we get it to be fixed so that it's not corrupted by the mind time and time again? So let's take this for now. Let's talk about intelligence and also contrast it with mind so that we can get the definitions, so that we can get the understanding with clarity. Yeah, a lot of times intelligence and mind are also used quite loosely. No, we kind of take it to be the same thing. And if you are using it very loosely, it's fine, as long as you also are cognizant that there's a technical difference between its functions. In terms of its structure, it's the same, because both are subtle by nature. No? Bhumirapo nalovayo khamano buddhi revacha ahankara itiyamme bhinna prakriti rastada. We know this verse. So there are five gross elements, earth, water, fire, air and ether. And there are three subtle elements, mind, intelligence and false ego. And there Krishna says, mind, intelligence and false ego. So there are two things. And all three, including the false ego, ahankar, are subtle. So that part is clear for now, that mind and intelligence are both subtle together with false ego. But they are different in its function. So is the ahankar, so is the false ego. So what's the difference? The difference is that the function of intelligence is to rationalize, is to think, is to evaluate. Whereas the function of mind is sankalpa and vikalpa. It is to desire and reject. It is to accept and reject. The mind desires. And desire can be twofold. Desire to do and desire to not to do. Can you relate to this now? Sometimes we want to do things. Sometimes we don't want to do those things. They are both function of mind. Desire, mind is the creature of habits. So whatever activities we are habituated to, that is what the mind will ask us to do. And whatever from past impressions it knows that we should not do, that we didn't like, then it will tell us not to do. So sankalpa and vikalpa. Whereas intelligence will evaluate what is right and what is wrong, and then activate the mind to do the right, to do the right and to do the wrong. Now here, the right and wrong, when the intelligence is evaluating, does not necessarily has to be based on scriptures. Because what is right from a scriptural point of view may not necessarily be right from a non-scriptural point of view. I'll give you an example to bring the point. Let's take an atheist. The atheist uses his intelligence to rationalize the non-existence of God. Agree? Simple, yeah? He has used his intelligence and he has evaluated to conclude that God does not exist. Now, that is completely non-scriptural, but he has still used his intelligence. And therefore, this is the intelligence. This intelligence is impure. This intelligence is conditioned. This intelligence is unsteady, which is what Prabhupada is talking about here. So there is impure intelligence and there is impure mind. So when we are talking about purification, what are we talking about? Are we talking about purification of the mind or the purification of the intelligence? The answer is, of course, both. But in our experience, you will note, after practicing Krishna consciousness for some time, the intelligence gets purified faster than the mind. Through intelligence, Shastra Chakshu, we know what is wrong. So now we are talking about right and wrong according to the scriptures. Yeah, let's talk about devotees now. Forget the non-devotees. So we know what is right through the scriptures. We have done Bhakti Vriksha, we have done Bhakti Shastri, come to many Bhagavatam classes, had many videos on YouTube. So we know what is right, what is wrong. But the reason we still engage in sense gratification is because the mind, which is still impure, acts faster than the intelligence. So both are impure, except that the intelligence is slightly more purified than the mind, let's say in our case. But because the mind says, let's do it, intelligence is still, you know, nidrasana. It's still sleeping. It's not even figured out that something is going on. So when the mind impels us into sense gratification, and mind generally impels us into sense gratification, which is short term, quickly, no? Instant bliss, is material bliss, so instant. So we compel to do it, we impel to do it. Whereas intelligence, which is more rational, no, an evaluatory process it goes through, is still sleeping, but its interest is generally for the jiva's long-term welfare. Mind is looking at short-term sensual enjoyment, whereas intelligence is looking after our long-term welfare. So there is a conflict in them when it is conditioned, when it is impure. But when the intelligence gets more purified than the mind, then the mind forces us to do things which the intelligence will resist. But the problem is, by the time we indulge in the activity, the intelligence has not even woken up. It's generally after the event that the intelligence says, oh, why did I do this? This was not supposed to be right. Take any example now, you know. Take gulab jamun. Eat one gulab jamun. Sense says, after the mind, we are habituated to eating it, eat it. Intelligence is still sleeping. Second gulab jamun. Eat it, intelligence is still sleeping. Third gulab jamun. The fourth, the fifth. When we eat the sixth gulab jamun, the mind says, take the seventh one as well. No problems. Now, intelligence is waking up because there's too much sugar in the body. Yeah? It has woken up from the sugar attack and says, one was enough for you. Why six? But the mind is conflicting to say, take the eighth as well. And maybe pack two or three for your families as well. Just take everything, because tomorrow you will want some more gulab jamun. So you see the difference, you know. So both is impure, but one is faster. Now, how do we fix this? So that's the problem statement. Both are impure. One is long term, one is short term. One is faster, one is slower. And no, there is a mismatch. How do we fix this? Let's take some examples. First one. Mind is like our internal, our internal notice board of sticky notes. Yellow sticky notes, used it? These days it's digital as well, yeah? You know, you can have on your laptop all the digital sticky notes. I have got many, I love them, you know, I like them. But what happens over time, those sticky notes, whether it's on the wall or on your laptop, there are too many of them, just too many sticky notes, and it can become very congested and can exhaust us. So mind is like that. It's a sticky note. It's an internal sticky note when all these notes are being stuck continuously. Some notes are stuck for short term, and when the wind blows, they are blown away. Some sticky notes are stuck for long term. Now the mind has absolutely no idea which sticky note is important, which sticky note is agent. It doesn't differentiate. Why? Because it does not have a discriminatory power. Discriminatory power lies with who? Intelligence. So just sticking it. Imagine, you know, an employee or a person just sticking the sticky notes on the whiteboard without discriminating why he is doing it. He's only sticking it because he's habituated to sticking it. So he just continuously sticks it. What is wrong, what is right, what is good, what is bad, what is short, what is long, what is prominent, what is not prominent, doesn't really matter. And mind is like that. Now, psychologically, it is proven the thoughts, no? The thoughts or the notes that you give more attention to takes more prominence and power. Remember this. Those thoughts, in other words, those notes that you stick here, if you give it more attention, it gains fuel to get power and prominence. It will want to come in the front, forcefully, impelling us to do things. Yeah? But what we need to do is sorting out. How do we sort out? If there are too many sticky notes in our mind or on the board, what do? We literally sit down one day and clean it up, right? Clean the ones that we don't need. Now, this requires intelligence. So we need to pin those notes that are important and bin those ones that are not important. Yeah. So pin the ones that are important, bin the ones that are not important at all, and forget about them. Put them in the recycle bin. So in that way, we have to, you know, decluster our clustered mind. Have you got this experience? You know, when sometimes when we wake up in the morning, and let's say we are physically a fit person. You know, we are healthy. There is not too much of weight we are getting. So we know for sure that bodily wise we are fit when we wake up, but mentally we are exhausted already without even doing anything. 10 minutes of waking up, we are buggered. Now that is called mental exhaustion. And why is that mental exhaustion happening? It is happening because of mental congestion. There is too many thoughts in the mind, not knowing what is wrong, what is right, what is important, what is less important. It's just congested, and that congestion itself can cause exhaustion. That's called mental stress, no? Or mental tiredness, or mental worn out. So what we need to do is get those thoughts out through intelligence, through devotion. We need to get those thoughts out. So as much as we always keep our body fit, sometimes when we have more weight than what we should, then we get physically tired. We have to lug around all our excessive luggage throughout the day, and the knees just give up. It's just too much. So how do we get rid of our bodily fats? Bodily fat. Two ways. One is dieting. The other one is exercise. Very simple, yeah? Dieting and exercise is how do we get rid of our bodily fat. You're hearing from a person who has tried this 3 times. In my life, to lose my body fat, 3 different ways I tried. I'll share with you offline if somebody is interested of my strategies. 3rd time it's working again. So we lose the body fat by dieting and exercising. Now similarly, we lose our mental fat by dieting and exercising again. But what does I mean metaphorically? What is dieting? What is exercising? When we are trying to lose our bodily fat, we give to the body the right amount of food at the right time. Agree? That is the definition of dieting. Right amount of food at the right time. So similarly, to get rid of the mental fat, we need to give the mind the right amount of thoughts at the right time. Don't give it ice cream, chocolate, cake, gulab jamun, jalebi, because this all puts the fat. So similarly, if we give the mind the thoughts that are anti-devotional service or non-devotional service, then they are mental fat that we are building up, and we'll get exhausted and frustrated, and it will come out in our character, in our disposition, in our behavior, it will come out. So restrict what we feed the mind, because it's already fat. Let's not make it more obese. Restrict what we feed the mind, and exercise through scriptural study. The scriptural study will purify the mind as well as sharpen our intelligence. Last one. Last example, let's take. This is Prabhupada's example, of course, which most of us are familiar with. Intelligence is like the parent and mind is like the child. Heard of this many times, yeah? Intelligence is like the parent, the mind is like the child. So you again can see the difference. The son and the mother, in one sense, are the same, because the son is the amshar of the mother. It comes from the same body. So it's structurally the same. But individuality is different. And there are 2 different functions for the mother and for the child. So similarly, the mind is like the child and the intelligence is like the parent, Prabhupada tells us. So the parent knows that the child can be naughty, especially in today's age now, when we have kids of this age and little bigger. It's just so much of, if we just sit quietly in oblivion thinking that the child will watch the right thing on YouTube or TikTok, Facebook, whatever, then we are mistaken. That is what? That is the intelligence is sleeping. When the mother or the father is lapsing in their responsibility, the naughty child will most likely watch something bad. Why? Because it's not, if you think of it, it's not the child's fault as such as well. It is because the child is unequipped at the moment in terms of his or her maturity to make the right decision. And we know that most of the time, actually they will make the wrong decision. I mean, seriously, we make wrong decisions. So how do we expect the child to make the right decision every time? So therefore, it is the responsibility of the parent to supervise the child to make the right decision. And a good parent is one who does what? Acts before the child acts. A good parent proactively acts before the child acts, not reactively acts when the child has made a mistake. When I was working in my office now, I had a boss who was just sharing with me his realizations. He said, he made the similar point, and I just like it. It registered in my mind, so I'll share with you. He said, if the child drops a jar of jam in the aisles of Safeway and breaks it when you are shopping, that is not the time to scold him. The time to teach him was that we are going shopping, and if you are picking something, make sure you pick it steady. Don't drop it. No? Please hold it tight. That is the time. That is the responsibility of the parent. But reactively, if the jar is broken and you are embarrassed, that's not the time, because as much as it's the child's fault, it is the mind, it is because the intelligence was still sleeping. Yeah, so like that. And that's why again they say, in psychological terms, when we are dealing with our children, we should always be making positive statements rather than the negative, even when we are saying the same message. For example, we can say two things to the child. Please, don't drop that jar of jam. Or we can say, please, hold it tightly. It's the same message. But when we say, please, don't drop that jar of jam, the child can drop the jar of jam, because his consciousness has been dovetailed into thinking that there's a word drop in my mind, drop, 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 and eventually I'll drop it. But when you say, please hold it tightly, then in his mind there's a picture that there is a jam and I need to hold it tightly, and subconsciously what happens, we hold it tightly. That's for children and as much as for us as well. Yeah. So it's always important to make a positive statement than the negative statements. And again, another example, and please take this one a little bit more seriously as well. I know of many examples, when children come back to temple, how in teenage days they kind of go away and then come back. A lot of times I've heard from parents that the child who attempted to come back to the temple, he didn't enjoy the experience of coming back, because of how the devotees treated him or her. And this is again all playing on the psychology. When we see a person coming to the temple after many days or many months or many years, what we want to say to them actually sincerely is that, welcome, good to see you. Now we can relay that message in two ways. Again, pick on the positive and the negative statement. Negative is what? I have not seen you for so many days. Where have you been? Now our intent is clear that we want to make him feel welcome. But the statement is negative. Where have you been? I have not seen you for so many days. Now how will you say it in positive? Somebody wants to attempt? The same statement, the same message in a positive way. How will you say it? Say it again, Natalie.
We are so happy to see you.
I'm so happy to see you. What else can you say? I saw you recently. What else? What are you doing these days? No? Yeah? Just see? The same message. Now, if we are that person, now put ourselves in their shoes, how will we feel when somebody says, and we were reluctant to come to temple, and somehow the other, and we are teenagers, by the way, when we try to come to the temple one day, and somebody says, where have you been? It's like, mind your own business, mate. That's how we may react, to say, who do you think you are? That's how the mind will think. But if somebody says, I'm so happy to see you, how do we feel now? My goodness, I thought these guys were crazy, but they are pretty good people, they were making me feel welcome again. So see, in terms of, let's go back to the story of the day. Yeah, we are talking about intelligence and mind. Intelligence is like the parent, child is like the mind. So as parent, two things. Proactively, we have to act before the mind makes a mistake. And secondly, proactively, we have to be positive. Always tell the mind positive things about Krishna, how he is beautiful, how devotees are good, how prasadam is nice, how the philosophy makes sense. Everything positive, keep feeding the mind. Somehow the other, the negative will get taken care of. Is that clear on intelligence and mind? Any questions on that before I talk about the other of the three changes? Yeah?
Between the mind and the intelligence, which is superior? Which takes your decision, which is more favorable to us?
Good question. So between the mind and the intelligence, which is superior? Part one of the question. Part two of the question is, which takes decision? Actually, that was part two. Part three was, which takes the better decision? The answer is that intelligence is certainly superior than the mind. Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita that higher than metta is mind. And when he says metta, he means bhumi, rapana, lobha, yok, no? The five gross elements that we talked about, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. These are the five gross elements. So higher than the gross elements, Krishna says, are the three subtle elements. And what are the three subtle elements? Mind, intelligence, and false ego. So higher than the mind is the intelligence, Krishna says. Why? Because the mind acts on impulses, whereas the intelligence works with on reasoning. So we can intellectually decide what is right, what is wrong. So that is the function of the intelligence. So intelligence is certainly higher. But when we are conditioned, then the problem is mind is faster, intelligence is slower. Mind is powerful, the intelligence is less powerful. So it's the opposite when we are conditioned. So we need to turn it around by making the intelligence powerful and quicker and swifter compared to the mind. Which one makes the right decision? The mind, as I said, does not make decisions at all. Yeah, mind does not make decisions. Intelligence makes the decision. So intelligence is the one that makes decision. Which one is favorable to our Krishna consciousness? Both. Both of them has to be purified so that they are thinking about Krishna only. No? In the mind there is Krishna, in the intelligence there is Krishna. Yeah?
There's one thing. The mind generates thoughts. Millions of thoughts keep coming, less and less and more.
Yeah.
The mind passes the thoughts to the brain.
Yeah.
The brain is the buddhi.
Correct.
Buddhi is the intelligence which is given.
Yes. Yeah, the brain, it's not necessarily always the brain will pass the intelligence will pass the information to the mind. The mind is on autopilot. The mind will act. It's not necessary for the aeroplane to fly always, for the pilot to be there. He can put the aeroplane on autopilot. So the mind is like plug and play. It will just play what it is habituated to. So let's take an example. Let's take something that, biryani, no? I like biryani. Now, last time when I ate biryani, it was spicy. So now my mind knows that biryani is bad for me. Next time when it sees it, it will not like the biryani. The intelligence can still be inactive completely, but the mind just knows vikalpa, reject this biryani. Now, on the other hand, there is another biryani somebody else made, and I loved it. Now mind knows, because mind is the map of impressions, yeah? So it has seen two types of biryani. One it knows is vikalpa, the other one it knows is sankalpa. And that is called autopilot now. This person cooking biryani, reject. I'm not pointing at anybody here. This person cooking the biryani, accept. That's all. Intelligence can be completely asleep at the moment. And it will just eat and reject according to its past habits. So mind can function on its own without the intelligence being activated. And that is the problem of a conditioned soul. It acts on autopilot on the wrong impressions of the mind. Yeah? Anything else? Yes?
Where does false ego come into this mind?
Okay, very good question. Somebody was listening, that means, yeah? Because we talked about the three subtle elements. False ego, mind and intelligence. We said there are three subtle elements. So what is the interplay of false ego between mind and intelligence? The interplay is that false ego, let's get back to the definition. Impure mind is what? That makes impure desires. Okay? Impure intelligence is what? That makes impure decisions. Now the difference between impure and pure is false ego. And I'll explain that again. Not again, little bit further. The presence of the false ego makes the mind make the wrong choice. Now what does false ego mean? False ego means ahankar. When we are ahankar, that means aham mameti. Everything is for my enjoyment. We have that purusha bhava, that we are the enjoyer. So when we think we are the enjoyer, which is a result of the false ego, then we want to make choices from which we can enjoy. That is called impure desire. When the false ego is removed completely or purified, which becomes a true ego, and true ego is what? Jivara Sarupa Rahari Krishna Nitya Das, that we are the servants of Krishna. So when we have true ego, then the mind has got pure desires to save the Lord. And the intelligence facilitates that by saying, mind, yes, go ahead and save the Lord. So what is the role of false ego in that? False ego makes the mind and intelligence impure. True ego makes the mind and intelligence pure. Clear? Okay. Yeah. You can think of correct. Those bad sticky notes are the, let's rephrase that. I think the notes on the sticky notes, if they are unfavorable to Krishna consciousness, they are the ahankaras. Yeah. So if we have the sticky notes with good notes, like key memory verses or something, then they are true ego, that this is for the pleasure of the Lord. Yes, Prabhu. I still have got more to cover, yeah, but I just want to finish this before we move into the next section, yeah?
What is purifying of heart? If heart is purifying,
yeah. Okay, what is the position of heart? I'm not gonna go any further than heart though, yeah. We'll stop there. Don't ask me about lungs and everything else as well. So heart is a matter because it's body. A person who is dead will still have heart. So heart is one of the five gross elements. But the reason we say offer our heart to Krishna is because in the heart resides Krishna. The soul and the super soul both reside in the heart, but they pervade the entire body, of course. So when we say offer our heart, it means offer our consciousness to Krishna, because the consciousness is not animated, the consciousness is activated, no? From the heart, because that's where the soul is, throughout the body. So when we offer the heart, that means we are offering our life and soul to Krishna. The soul is in the heart. But it does not literally mean that we go to an organ shop and buy a heart and give it to Krishna to say, this is my heart, and I'll put somebody else's heart in my body. That's not what it means. No, it's not the literal physical heart. It is the consciousness. It is called chetana, the cheta, the chitta. Yeah? Okay. Let's talk about the other changes. What were the other changes? Second change? First one was the change of intelligence, which we spoke about. Next one? Change of body. No? Prabhupada says that intelligence means that we stop the change of bodies. Remember? Which means no birth. Now this can be a little contradictory or confusing at times, because sometimes we are told that we should finish all our material business and go back to Godhead, go back to Vaikuntha. The other times we are told that a devotee does not care whether he is in Vaikuntha or is in Swarga or is in Naraka. It's the same as long as he has got the seva of Krishna. What is important is the service of Krishna rather than the location from where we save Krishna. So this may seem contradictory. No, really we have to go back to Godhead and don't change our bodies anymore. Because once we go back to Godhead, there is no change of body. That is it. No, we'll have our own forms in the Vaikuntha planets. And the other times we are told, we don't mind taking birth after birth after birth after birth. Which means what? Constantly taking one body after the other, provided we have got seva to Krishna. Now which one is right? Because both can be right and both can be not right. So how do we reconcile the apparent contradiction? The way we reconcile it is that our Vedic spirituality operates at multiple levels. For that matter, even bhakti also operates at multiple level. Now, we can have Lord Kapila tells Mata Devahuti that there can be bhakti in the mode of passion, bhakti in the mode of ignorance, bhakti in the mode of goodness, and bhakti in the mode of pure goodness. Now, bhakti does not change. It is the sadhaka or the practitioner who is changing, depending on which mode he is in when we are doing bhakti. So bhakti is constant, but the practitioner can be changing. So Vedic spirituality operates at multiple levels, so that it is all inclusive, you know, to everybody, to whatever levels they may be at. So now you take this example of whether we want to go back to Godhead, is that our desire? Or we want to take birth after birth after birth in this material world and save the Lord? Which desire is the right one? The answer to that is, just depends at what level we are, as simple as that. Depending on what level we are, if we aim for something higher, that is nice. But not forgetting that yet there may be something that is even higher than what we are currently aiming. Let's give you an example. Let's say they are two children of the same parent. Two children. Now, and both are, let's say, academically at different levels. The first child scores 40 every time, and the second child scores 80 every time. Which one will be rewarded, which one will be scolded? Obviously, the one getting 40 will be scolded. The one getting 80 will be rewarded. No problems, correct? Now, this is constant marks they normally get. In one of the exams, the child who was getting 40 gets 60. And the child who was getting 80 gets 60. Both of them get the same mark. From 40 to 60, from 80 to 60. Which one will be rewarded and which one will be scolded now? You tell me. What's your name?
Gopal.
Gopal, you tell me which one will be rewarded, which one will be scolded?
Yes, like 40, 60.
Yeah. Why? Because? But the child who is being scolded from coming from 80 to 60, thank you, it's like, why are you scolding me? Both of us got 60. If your barometer was 60, then neither of us deserve praise or neither of deserve chastisement. But why unfair? And the reason the parent is doing it is because, as you said, as Gopal said, from 40 to 60 is a step up and it deserves rewards. Whereas from 80 to 60 is a step down and therefore the chastisement. Now, put that in our case. For us, who find the material world miserable, dukhalayam ashashvatam, it's full of miseries, if our desire is to get out of this place and go to Vaikuntha, that is a step up. And there is nothing wrong with that desire. Now you take an exalted devotee who makes the statement that I don't mind taking birth after birth after birth in this material world. Where is he coming from? He's operating at that 100%. For him, it does not matter whether he is in Vaikuntha or in material world. For him, it's the service of the Lord that is most important. So he's blissing at that level. It doesn't really matter where he is. But for us, it matters. And this is why an exalted devotee, listen to this carefully as well, yeah, please. An exalted devotee always condemns, you know, the impersonal liberation. Salokya sarishti samipya sarupe katva matpita diyamanam na grihananti vina matsevanam jana. A pure devotee condemns impersonal liberation. Why? Because it's a step down for him. He is blissing out in Krishna consciousness to be in a place which is not material but is spiritual, which is Brahma Jyoti. It's a step down for him. So he condemns it. But he condemns not out of arrogance, but out of humility, to say, I want to save Krishna, full stop. Where I save him doesn't matter, but the last thing that I want is impersonal realization. I don't want them. But for devotees like us, getting out of the material world, if that's the desire, fine. As long as we also understand that one day we will get purified so much that it will not matter, you know, whether the Lord takes us back or puts us here, as long as there is service to Krishna. I'll give one example to make that point. Last example. Picturize the prasadam hall. Because I know it's almost 9 o'clock, yeah? Picturize the prasadam hall, you know, and somebody's birthday is there. Anybody's birthday today? No. Yes? No? Somebody's birthday is there, and there's a feast. And feast and birthday means what? It's chock-a-block. Prasadam, I mean, not probably now, but just pre-COVID days, yeah? There was no place to step in. And what is the ambience in the prasadam hall? It's crowded. It's noisy. To some extent, it's dirty because there is no prasadam on the floor. There is no space. There is congestion. There is buckets coming left and right. But what we are doing, we are trying to gate crash, push all the devotees aside, so that we can be in the prasadam hall, the fest, we just get very big bits of everything. We want to have the cake and eat it as well, yeah, because it's better. Now, what is happening? The prasadam hall, in one sense, is a very inconvenient place at the moment for the devotee, because it's just so noisy and busy. But we are willing to overlook all the inconvenience. Why? Because the nectar in the prasadam is higher than the inconvenience of the structural layout of the prasadam hall and the logistical inconveniences that are there. The prasadam is more relishable than looking at the situation of the prasadam hall. This is exactly how a pure devotee sees. He sees that the bliss in bhakti is so much that he is willing to overlook the inconveniences of the material world miseries. It does not matter to him because the nectar is so much. So whether you put him in Vaikuntha where there is no miseries, or you put him in the Kuntha where there is all miseries, he is overlooking both. What he is only looking at and experiencing and relishing is the joy and the bliss of saving Krishna. Yeah? That is what it means when Prabhupada says we have to end the change of body. That is at our level. No? Let's stop the cycle of birth and death. But at the highest level, if Krishna gives us another birth as preachers, as his servants, absolutely no problems with that as well. So that was about change in body. Yeah, I'm going to park the other two, the change of function and the change of profession, and I'll come back to them maybe at the back end, because I want to just quickly bring us to why we are discussing all this. Yeah, we are discussing, and that's 10 minutes, yeah? And then in another 10 minutes, then I'll take some questions. Why are we discussing all this? We are discussing all this because Narad Muni is being cursed by Daksha. Now, why is Daksha cursing Narad Muni? Let's go into that to see why this is all happening. What is happening as a backdrop to this is that Daksha is the same as the son of Brahma, by the way, except that he has taken another body. So if you go way back, Daksha was the son of Brahma, and he offended Lord Shiva. And then, you know, he got a goat's head and all that, we park all that. Then in his next life, he's now born as the son of the Prachetas. No? So here, Daksha means an expert progenitor. His seva to Krishna is to progenate, because he's saying that there is not enough population in the world and he wants to progenate. No? So he creates 11,000 sons. The first 10,000 that he creates are called the Hari Yashvas, yeah? And they are the 10,000 sons. And he tells the 10,000 sons to go and progenate. No? Go and increase the population. And in those times, before increasing the population, a person would go and do austerity. Just as for us as well, Prabhupada said, if you want to increase the population, then go and do Garbhadana Samskar. So similarly, they went to do some austerity, you know, at a particular mountain. Vindhya Mountain, I think, from memory. One or the other. Anyway, so they did lots of austerities to please the Lord. So what happened there when they were doing the austerity, the 10,000 sons of Daksha, Narad Muni appears there and says, what? Why are you doing this? Why are you getting engaged in all these, you know, worldly affairs of increasing the population and all that? Better than this is to do bhakti. And Narad Muni preaches to them through an allegorical story, just as he had preached to the Hariyashva's grandparents, which were the Prachinbharis, also through an allegorical story. That allegorical story, which was the Puranjana allegory was a very long allegory. Whereas here, Narad Muni compacts the same philosophy into 10 subjects in 3 verses, or maybe 4 verses, just, you know, few verses before this, today's verse. He packs them up. 10 subjects. And because it tells in an allegorical way, the sons of Daksha, which are the Hariyashvas, they all unanimously interpret it in the same way, what is its meaning. So in one of the allegory, amongst the 10 that Narad Muni had given, one of them was, what is the use of having an unsteady intelligence? Connects, you can connect the dots now. What is the use of having an unsteady intelligence? In other words, hey mates, why are you engaging your intelligence in progeny, in progenating this world, when you can use the same intelligence steadily and do Krishna Bhakti? And the Hariyashvas get convinced and do Krishna Bhakti, and they all become Brahmacharis. Now, when Daksha hears it, that Narad Muni has delivered the 10,000 children, he's not so happy. Why? And he deserves not to be happy in one sense, because his seva to Krishna is what? To progenate the world. So he's not happy. But he lets it go in second attempt. So second time he creates 1,000 children, which are called Savalashvas. No? They are 1,000 children. So total 11,000 children. And when Narad Muni hears that another 1,000 candidates are there for preaching, he opens up another Bhakti Vriksha, gets all these 1,000 there, and then says, hey, forget about progeny, might hear this story and do Bhakti. And Narad Muni uses one very interesting technique of preaching this time. What does he say? Note this down as well if you are preachers. Yeah, he says, after telling them the allegory in a very simple way this time, he says this particular point, which is very profound. He says, just follow your senior brothers. Just follow your elder brothers. Powerful statement. It happens, you know, when you are preaching sometimes, especially in Bhakti Vrikshas, you know, if one person becomes Krishna conscious, and then you just say, you know, how he became Krishna conscious, the others get, you know, inspired by that person. It's a real life example, you know, of somebody getting transformed. So Narad Muni says, you know, your brothers accepted it, and there were 10,000. You are only 1,000 outnumbered, so just follow them. And what happens? The 1,000 Swarasvas also become Brahmacharis and become Krishna conscious, and they reject the task of progenation. Now what happens to Narad Muni, to Daksharya at this point? When 11,000 attempts have been unsuccessful, how do you think he will react? Furious. He is furious at Narad Muni, and then he curses Narad Muni to say that this is the so-and-so curse. Now, if you think of it, actually, Narad Muni approaches Daksha after delivering the 11,000 children. Now the question arises, why does Narad Muni approach Daksha after doing something that he knows that Daksha will not be very happy with, because his role is to progenate, my role is to deliver, I've delivered the 11,000 children, Narad Muni goes to Daksha. Why do you think he goes there? To get cursed? That will not be a very intelligent thing to do, yeah? To go to somebody who is furious? To deliver. Who said that? It's simple, no? Narad Muni thinks, I have delivered Prachinbhari. No, they are ancestor. The Prachetas were delivered. Lord Shiva, Rudra, Gita chanting. I delivered the Hariyashvas, 10,000 achievement. I delivered the 1,000 children. Now, why should Daksha leave out? He also deserves the bliss that is there to enjoy. So, pure devotee always approaches somebody with compassion. That's the point. The only reason Srila Prabhupada went to the US, amidst all the inconvenience of the material miseries there, it is only because of compassion to the suffering souls, to say, I'm going to give you, I'll deliver you from the cycle of birth and death. So out of compassion. So now you see what is happening here. Bring it together, yeah, and I'll stop there. Daksha is doing his service to the Lord. Let's not minimize that. He's doing his service to the Lord by doing progenation, except that there is a karma yoga. Karma yoga means, you know, doing some karma for the Lord. Narad Muni is a bhakti yogi. He is also saving the Lord, and his business is to deliver the suffering souls. Now you bring the two head on head, Narad Muni and Daksha. One karma yogi, one bhakti yogi. clash. Clash in what? Service. Been through that many times? When there's clash in service with devotees, one devotee says this, the other devotee says this, and there is a clash. And both are devotees, and both are trying to save the Lord, but there is a clash. Now, how are we going to react? We can react in two ways, wrong and right, of course. If we react like Daksha, we can curse the other devotee, which is a Vaishnava aparad. We won't go and curse for sure, but we'll offend the devotees. That is called Vaishnava aparad, to be avoided. That's the lesson to be learned out of this pastime. Avoid Vaishnava aparad. Or we can react like Narad Muni. How does Narad Muni react when he's cursed? Now, first of all, what was the curse? The curse from Daksha to Narad Muni was what? That I curse you that you will not have a permanent residence. Now, we put in our so much money to apply for PR, yeah? And Narad Muni has been cursed that you will not have PR, no permanent residence. You know, no Australia, no India, nothing. Just move around everywhere. And Narad Muni sees the curse as a blessing. Narad Muni is elevated enough to counter curse Daksha. But he doesn't do that. He takes the curse as a blessing. This is the art of bhakti. The art of bhakti is to look at the curse as a blessing. The art of bhakti is to look at a miserable situation as an opportunity to get out of that situation. So Narad Muni takes the curse as a blessing to say, my God, I'm going to be a Parivarjaka Acharya. I'll be traveling around the world and preaching. What else can I have asked for? And he remains tolerant. What are the abhushan of a devotee? What are the characters of a devotee? Titikshva karu nikaha suradam sarvadehinam achata satrava santa sadhava sadhu bhushana. So titikshva karunika suradam sarvadehinam. So a devotee is very tolerant. A devotee is very merciful. A devotee is very calm. A devotee is always very compassionate. So Daksha doesn't Narad Muni doesn't retaliate. So that's your take-home message. When faced with a conflict, you want to be Daksha or you want to be Narad Muni. The choice is yours. Mind will tell you to become Daksha if the mind is habituated that way, or the mind will tell you to become Narad Muni if that's how the mind has been trained. So when that situation comes, calm it down and activate the intelligence, which is this. This is the intelligence. And intelligence tells us that in this particular episode, Sukhdeva Goswami is telling Maharaj Parikshit, Maitreya is telling Vidura, Sutta Goswami is telling the sages of Naimisharanya, Srila Prabhupada is telling us that the right thing is to be Narad Muni. Be tolerant, don't overreact, don't retaliate, be compassionate to everybody at any point in time, at every point in time. That is intelligence. Activate the intelligence, activate the intelligence. Alpa Kidya, Grantha Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki. Any further questions or comments? Yes? Okay, so the question is, when we are talking about desires, is it the soul desiring or is the mind desiring? The answer to that question is, the soul is desiring. No, the mind is, although it is subtle, there are 5 gross elements and 3 subtle, which we discussed about. But all 8 of them together are material. Okay, so matter is unconscious. It cannot do anything on its own at all. For example, again, when a person dies, when the soul is removed from the body still has mind and intelligence and whatever it used to have, but it's just not operating anymore. So the soul desires. So the soul desires, but the problem when we are conditioned, which is why we are called conditioned souls, is that the soul is desiring something that is conditional, something that is impure, because there is a layer of ahankar in front of the soul, and it is making wrong choice one after the other. So the desire is from the soul, the body facilitates us do it, provided it is sanctioned by the Lord. So there are 3 doers. Bhagavad Gita Krishna tells us there are 3 doers. The Jiva, the Jagat and the Jagadish. You can remember it says 3 Jais. The Jiva and the Jagat and the Jagadish. So the Jiva is the soul. That its function is to desire. The Jagat, which is the 5 gross elements, its function is to facilitate. And the Jagat and the Jagadish, which is the Ishvara, which is the Lord, its function is to sanction. Not even a blade of grass can move without the sanction of the Lord, we say. Yeah. So the soul desires. But it can be pure or impure desire. If we are not conditioned, it will be a pure desire. If we are conditioned, it will be an impure desire. Okay? Nice question. Thank you. Anything else? So whenever we are in problem, we put Krishna in the center of the problem. Yeah, but I think the nicer way to say it is will be, you know, whenever we are in problem, situate ourselves in Krishna, in Krishna consciousness. We don't want, when we place Krishna in the problem, it becomes, you know, grammatically it sounds like, you know, we are offering Krishna some problems. I know what you mean. So the intent is, yes, whenever we are in problems, no. Situate ourselves in Krishna and the problem will diminish. For example, no, in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is in problem. Chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is in biggest problem that none of us will ever face. Both sides of him are armies and a war is imminent, like Ukraine and Russia. Imagine you are caught between Ukraine and Russia. What will you do? So what Arjuna does, although he's surrounded by problems left and right and center, he walks right in the middle of the problem. He walks right in the middle of the two armies. But what he does, he takes Krishna with him. He doesn't say to Krishna, when the war is before, you know, before the Bhagavad Gita is spoken, he doesn't say to Krishna, that Krishna, I'm in deep problem at the moment. You stay here, I'll just walk there and then see who is on the other side. He doesn't do that. What he says, oh my Lord, take the chariot in the middle of the two armies. So take the chariot means what? It actually means, you come with me. I'm in problem, you come with me. So whenever we are in problems, always keep Krishna with us. And then what do? We tell Krishna, or we tell the problem actually, that no matter how big the problem, oh my dear problem, just know that the Lord is much bigger than the problem. What the mind does, it makes us believe that the problem is bigger than the Lord. That's the function of the mind, yeah? It makes us fools and leads us to believe that the problem is bigger than the Lord. But when we activate the intelligence, then what we can do, we can tell the problem that, hey, see how big Krishna is. In front of Krishna, the problem is trivial. And that's how we solve it. So always be Krishna conscious and the problem will diminish. Or at least if not diminish, we can tolerate the problem. Yeah? The Pandavas went through problems, everybody went through problems, but they always had Krishna with them. So the problem looked very trivial to the point that Mother Kunti said, let these problems come again and again and again. Of course, we can't pray like that. But at least what we can say, that this problem will also pass. Yeah? Already? We'll park it here. Nandashinath Bhagavatam Gija Srila Prabhupada ki Jai. Thank you, dear devotees. Hare Krishna.